Hi, everyone. This is Joe Bianco, co-producer and co-host of the Defining Moments podcast. As humans, storytelling is in our DNA. We organize events and make sense of our experiences through stories. We tell and retell stories to make ourselves known and to develop meaningful connections with others. Our stories take many shapes and forms, from the fleeting tales we exchange around office water coolers to the posts we share on social media and everything in between. We often define or recognize stories by their traditional features: character, setting, plot, conflict, and events that unfold in temporal sequences leading to some type of resolution. These are the stories we hear at bedtime, watch on TV, or read in novels and memoirs. Some of our most profound stories, however, don't conform to conventional narrative formats. These stories, often of trauma or other complex lived experiences, reside not just in our heads and hearts, but within every cell of our bodies. Words and conventional story formats are often poor conduits for embodied narratives. These intricate, layered, and even chaotic stories reside deep within us, vying for expression but lacking a format to accommodate them. In today's episode, we're talking to Dr. Marie Thompson about her pioneering work in narrative mapping, a rich and generative technique she developed for eliciting, expressing, and witnessing the complex, deeply embodied stories that so many of us long to tell. Marie is a professor of communication at Wright State University, where she teaches courses in health communication, race, gender, and health, interpersonal communication, and end-of-life communication. Her research focuses primarily on narrative mapping, a form of visual storytelling she developed that will be the centerpiece of today's episode. On our Facebook page, we provide links to Marie's health communication articles on narrative mapping, including her 2024 Defining Moments piece on narrative mapping as a topography of listening and healing. On a personal note, Marie was the first invited speaker at the Storytelling Institute's new workshop series called What If? It's a forum that showcases scholars whose work disrupts the status quo and invites new possibilities for health, healing, and social change. That was when I first learned the magic of narrative mapping, and I'm eager to share it with listeners today. Marie, welcome to Defining Moments.
Troy, an Iraqi vet, had agreed to do an interview and narrative map for my research on vets and their families returning from Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. Troy now worked on his map. I sat quietly reviewing my notes while contemplating our interview. His stories and reflections lingered for me. Adjusting to civilian life, navigating the topography of a body now stripped of its weapons, but whose body continued to carry weapons from within. And yet, he held no compass, no anchor for directing his path toward reintegration. Though we had talked for nearly 2 hours, he now mapped form to his narrative, rearticulating meanings in ways neither he nor I could have imagined. When he was finished, I asked him, "Is this a heart monitor?" No, he said. "It's like a seismograph, and your world is shaking all around." In that moment, Troy rendered clear those details. Here, he exclaimed, was boot camp and war, homecoming, and this final piece is integration. Every landmark further distinguished the terrain of his lived living experience.
Marie, what is a narrative map and how does it differ from other forms of stories or narrative?
A narrative map is an invitation for participants to render form to their story. They can imagine their stories taking place across time, through time. Importantly, the stories emerge from their bodies. No matter how many times I talk about narrative mapping and people come in with an idea about what they're going to create, they inevitably will tell me, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. This isn't what I planned. So they're very organic in their emergence as people become a part of the process and are invited to deeply sit with themselves and listen in ways in which we tend not to listen to in this world that we live in. They are not mind maps or cognitive maps, and I'm really clear about that, in that the stories move away from the logic of the brain and move into the experience of the body.
So what types of stories are especially suited, in your opinion, to being mapped narratively?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I can't think of any stories that don't have potential for narrative mapping. Because I've used narrative mapping in so many diverse contexts, it's been extraordinary for me what people bring to the experience of mapping and what they take away from it. And as somebody who's engaged in holding space, creating space, and witnessing, it's been profound to see what emerges out of those stories. So some examples might be work that I've done with low-wage restaurant workers and health. So looking at the relationship between work and health. I worked with returning Iraq and Afghanistan vets and their families to look at reintegration and healing. And so those stories are very different depending whether you're a vet or even active military, whether you're a spouse or a parent. So all of those stories share the same theme, but bring with it or bring to the maps potent lived experiences that reach beyond just the telling of a story.
It's interesting that you talk about vets. I know you've worked a lot with them. In our second year curriculum at the med school at OU, we have Veterans Week. And during that week, we have a panel of veterans who talk about their stories and their healthcare experiences. And invariably, whenever they get to the point where they're trying to describe to non-veterans what the process of returning to civilian life is like,
yes,
words fail.
Indeed.
They fail.
Indeed. I think that is the power of the narrative maps. And that is the power that the body holds for us, that there isn't always language to express what we innately understand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mentioned before as we were talking, like the language of the body, we have been disavowed of paying attention to that language. We've told our intuition is hogwash, or there's a logic in the mind that the mind is superior. And there's so much more research in this contemporary era about the wisdom of the body, and is the body actually the brain that we really need to understand. So,
right. And accessing those stories that reside in the body as opposed to residing in the brain takes a certain method, right? Not just conventional talk.
Indeed. I'm so grateful that you are attentive to the potency of creating space. And I think in this last article, The Topography of Healing, I really made an emphasis on the potency of deep listening. And the more work that I do, I come to see that as a sense of presence, right, in the field of somatics, like being present and sensing each other. It brings me back to early in my graduate work, Martin Buber's I Thou, or the concept of Ubuntu, I am because we are. So that notion of our interconnectedness, our interrelatedness, doesn't always happen in our heads.
Mm-hmm. So when you're working with people on narrative maps, it's, I think, very tempting to think, okay, the map that they draw, this sort of, it's not even a diagram that would be demoting it, but this visual story that they end up drawing is the end product, but it's actually not. You've created a very thoughtful and layered series of steps that get the person to the point where they can coax out that story that needs to be told. And then you follow it up with additional time. So do you want to walk us through maybe what that looks like?
Sure.
Start to finish?
Sure. And again, it's such an astute attention to the details that are important, whether we can do a linear read on this. So as a researcher, and as a qualitative researcher, I come in with sort of an open-ended protocol, right? I'm more inclined to be led where the participant wants to share their story and make sense of that and work to connect that. That brings me information that I, or a sense of understanding that I wouldn't have had I not been so open. So right away as a researcher, I'm developing a sense of openness and curiosity and of just being. Like, I'm very curious about who you are and what your experience is and what can I learn from you, as opposed to come in and saying, here's what I need to know for my project. So that's a part of creating space, developing that rapport. And again, our bodies are communicating safety in that regard, right? If somebody's more, if we're more determined to have the exact answers that we want, I know I tend to be more rigid, and then I get in my head, like, am I getting it right or am I getting it wrong or what should I say? Maybe I shouldn't say that. Whereas opposed to bringing in openness and again, over and over again, the curiosity and a desire to understand and to just be with the story. I think that's a part of it. So as a researcher, that's really a part. And we go through the questions. So by the time we go through whatever questions that I have or however the story unfolds, then I invite them to mapping. And by whether I'm working in the classroom or with a person, there's always that, like, I'm not an artist. Like, what do you want me to do? Like, I don't know if you experienced that in the workshop, but most people get terrified that they're not going to be able to draw right. So again, there's a lot of invitation to just be, that it doesn't matter to me what your story looks like, that there's no one way or right way. I remind them that this is their story now in this moment. As a graduate student, Dr. Lynn Harder was always like, punctuated moments, Marie, in this time and in this space. And that's something that I've carried forward to remind people. You can always go back to your map. This map is yours. You can create another map. You can add to it. In this moment in time, what are you compelled? What is moving through you that wants to emerge on the paper in whatever form? So there's a bit of, like, again, coaxing and creating comfort and this space of non-judgment, right? Whoever you are, however you show up, I am curious and I have something to learn from you and with you. And then I usually... Okay, so for that, and as a researcher, then I'll go through, well, after they do that, and I let them sit with the map, and I ask them, you know, is there anything else? Is there anything you want to add? Or is there anything missing? And then I invite them to share, like, what came up from them. I think both participants and myself have been really surprised that no matter how long the interview has been, things that we didn't get to discuss came up or revealed themselves on the map. And I think about that as a gardener. I think about how it is that we dig up the earth and then we make space for things to grow. And I think a part of that, being in an interview where people feel safe and willing, like, to just explore themselves and their story, that allows so much more to emerge. And again, like, the story that moves from the body that comes out beyond language, that didn't show up in the interview. When I'm using this as a pedagogical tool, I have the beautiful expansion of time, right? So I have on all of my syllabi, we talk about this the first day of class, pedagogical commitment of nonviolent communication. That's something that's embedded in each and every assignment. So deep listening, mutual respect. That's a huge shift where they begin to learn what listening is. It's more than the texts that we learn about listening, like all of the logics of listening. This is the experience of suspending what you think you know in order to be in the presence of another, right? And so they've had those weeks where they're practicing listening and they're doing more reflective work. And then when it comes to the mapping, I create this for classes, and I create particular meditations for workshops. So depending on where I am, where I get invited, and what the theme of that is, I'll sit with myself to work to create an intentional meditation that takes and invites people through the process. Usually that's something that involves the body and listening. And there's a particular piece of music that in all the years I've been doing this, I have found to be really helpful in helping workshop participants and students in class just be. There is something that I cannot define to be in the experience of 90 people in a room or 30 people in a classroom. 80 people, even online, the experience of people deeply committed or deeply engaged in rendering stories mm-hmm. into some visual landscape. It's just more potent than I have the language to describe. So it is very intentional. The interview as a researcher is intentional in terms of how I bring myself to the space and opening the questions in respectful ways and not pressing people where they don't want to go. And the same thing in the classroom. Like, I don't demand that people turn their maps over to me. Mm-hmm. I tell them that I'm interested and they're contributing to research if they want to share, but their maps are theirs and their story. So again, that's like deep mutual respect, this notion of I value your story. The other thing that I think is really important to pay attention is we're all sort of intrigued by very potent stories, and the notion of vulnerability is it's just really powerful. It's a powerful experience. I mean, the first part of the title of my dissertation is The Wisdom of Vulnerability, right? I learned from listening to vets and their families, like what wisdom comes from opening ourselves. What I really work on in the classroom and with workshop participants is, and this is already established in a research protocol, right? But in workshops in the class, is like how to help them not exploit themselves, because they will be sharing their maps. So I also then will talk about you can share what you want. You can put things on the map that have meaning to you, and other people might not recognize that. One of my favorite maps is a woman who wrote something under the hair on her head, and I can't read it, but she knows it's there. Mm-hmm. To me, that was like so powerful and so beautiful, such a beautiful example of protecting herself even while she shares her story. So again, that's a part of the process, is your story belongs to you, and I honor whichever pieces and parts you have a willingness to share. I don't want to exploit your stories, and particularly with younger people, right? There's that, like, what do they call that? The trauma dumping or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, I've heard students talk about that. I'm like, this isn't trauma dumping. This is you being true to the stories in your body, in your experience that have been harboring there. And how can you make space for them for your own growth and understanding?
It's a beautiful process, because when I think of stories, or when I think of, okay, there's a storyteller, someone with a story, they tell that story, they find a way to get it out of themselves, and then they bring in other people. What you're talking about as an essential ingredient of this narrative mapping process is that to get to that person's unique story on their terms, there needs to be a relational context.
Indeed. Indeed.
And a special kind, right? It can't just be the presence of someone else.
Yeah.
But a very carefully cultivated, safe, sort of contained space.
Yeah. Again, back to Martin Buber's I Vow, yeah. Bruner's notions on dialogue, Bakhtin's notions on narrative, like Ubuntu, right? Like all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's so important, because the map itself, we'll have visuals of the maps on the link to the articles on the Facebook page for our listeners, but no two maps look anything alike.
God.
Because there's actually no rules or no directives, right? Like, no. When you get to the map making part of this process, what do you say? Like,
I do say that. And I'll tell you, it's so fascinating that how scared people are of no rules. Like, I don't understand. What do you want me to do? Like, how do you want me to do this? And I continually have to say, like, just invite them back to their breath and that breath in the body and your story and listen to the wisdom within you. I think reminding people, no matter who they are or where they are, that there is a deep wisdom within them. And we live in a world that doesn't cultivate the space to engage more often, more frequently, more authentically, more honestly with that wisdom.
Hi, folks. This is Joe breaking in for just a second. I've been talking to Dr. Marie Thompson about her seminal work in narrative mapping. For your convenience, we've placed links to her health communication articles on our Facebook page. Okay, back to the conversation. You talk in your articles about the chaos, the cacophony that drowns out our ability to actually hear the stories in our bodies that we want to tell. And I think that that's so true, whether it's literal noise, whether it's the noise of technology and the next flashy, shiny thing, the noise of our own self-reproach, whatever, all the voices we have in our head impede us from accessing things that we want to express that don't necessarily lend themselves into words and language.
And what we know about that, right, is we know that, well, particularly with regards to trauma, we know that trauma can show up as chronic illnesses in our lives. So those stories that get buried show up one way or another.
And then when the map is produced, let's say in your research protocol, that's not the culmination of the process for you, right?
No. I mean, especially with regards to Troy's map, like I sit with these maps, I write about the maps, I think about them, but I literally sit with the maps that I'm writing about. And I'm kind of embarrassed to say that it took me a number of years to actually sitting with Troy's map and ask myself finally, like, oh, what does a seismograph do? And so his words, like in his map, you see lines. Whenever I show this at a workshop where medical professionals are, the lines look like a heart monitor, or they'll say, that person's having a myocardial infarction, like get them to the hospital. But really, like Troy talks about the first part is basic training. And then there's a curve in the lines, which surprised me and would surprise most people. That's war. There's ups and downs, but it's curvy, right? So it's predictably unpredictable. It's gonna have high points and low points. And there's like a measure of like evenness in the initial homecoming, and the reintegration is nothing but sharp up and down lines. And originally I just thought about that in terms of the experience of what those sharp, dramatic highs and lows might teach us. But as I thought about what does a seismograph do, I guess it's much like what we just said, like what stories don't emerge, stay in the body and show up one way or another. So a seismograph like speaks from deep within the earth. We don't always feel what the seismograph measures or reports, but it doesn't mean that it isn't there. And that's one of my favorite maps because it's so simple, profound, and poignant.
Yeah, so Marie and I are looking at this map, which she just described, and like she said, if I saw this map, I would think it were maybe an EKG, maybe a different kind of EKG, but Troy was able, from what you read in the beginning of the podcast, he was able to locate every benchmark of importance. And so what this map does is, not only does it tell his story, but it also gives you a sense, like a seismograph, of the magnitude of the
thank you.
The parts of that story.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I'm really appreciative of that framing, the magnitude, particularly of reintegration and even basic training, like, well, that's a real shock to our system, right? Yeah.
Right. So it's this this thing that could seem so static actually has dimensions to it. It has rhythm to it. Mm-hmm. Looking at it, it's not static at all. And that kind of pops off the page. I encourage our listeners to view the articles and see these maps because they're fascinating to look at. In addition to vets, you've worked with other populations on narrative mapping. Mm-hmm. Are there any particularly memorable maps or stories that you encountered in your work over the years?
Oh, gosh. There are so many. I think one of the more powerful ones, I'm going to show this to you, and I know that listeners can't see it, and we'll do our best to describe it, but this woman is an artist, an art teacher. She happened to be married to a captain in the army. And this map struck me so profoundly as a mother of, you know, an active military person and as somebody who lost a brother in Vietnam. This was really, really profound to me. But her story says this. You see this big heart up here in the left corner, and it's got like this black line and scars. And she says, I got into this hot mess because I fell in love with a military person. And she talks about the blood pouring down over, she has a house here on the right, into her happy home. And like, what is in the shingles? Like, she's so specific in the shingles. What is your happy? What is your happy? Like, how much she struggles. She has writing in the sky that you can't necessarily see. But this part here, this actually became a chapter in my dissertation, The What If Bombs. Mm. So she talked about what it means to be a partner living with the anxiety of somebody who's in active military combat, who's in that era, multiple back-to-back deployments. She talks about her love of her country. She talks about the death. All of this is not necessarily in language, even though there's some words behind it, but the potency of that map has never ceased to just compel me into more and more questions and more potency of what, in particular, family support systems manage when people go to war. And we say, thank you for your service. And, you know how vets feel about some of that. And this notion of the ways in which women in particular carry this burden is something our country doesn't necessarily recognize, right? And so that was really quite powerful.
Looking at this map, I'm struck by how it's all cast in shades of red, white and blue.
Yes.
There's a little green there too, yeah. Right? And how it looks at once like a Norman Rockwell quintessential beautiful homescape. But then there's other things happening, like you said, what looked to me like almost sharks.
Sharks, yeah.
Sharks actually raining down from the sky, threatening maybe a heart-like bubble in the upper left-hand corner. Mm-hmm. And the path leading to the house is a road that looks like an American flag. Mm-hmm. And the letters etched in are not visible to me, but you can tell that she's imprinted this whole scene with words that are just layered onto and support the sort of like powerful visual that she's created. This is a scene that's located in no place or time.
Not right now, yeah.
Yeah. It's just located in her state.
She talks about, like, you know, being an army wife and how proud she is, right? So this undergirds the entire experience. There are people that have been lost. Here is the bombing, these what-if bombs, these shark-like looking figures, right? So you're right, like, all of this undergirds, like, what it, when we think about home, you know? So it's a beautiful layering, yeah.
Oh, that's incredible.
I don't know that. I mean, I could go on and on about some that are so simple. And I think, let me just show you this one that I worked with I was working, doing a pilot study with families with asthma. And I'd been invited to do, you know, help create some health literacy around working with families with asthma by a couple of physicians. physicians, and they were talking about doctors, doctors, doctors. And I said, what about the patient's story? Mm. And beautiful, beautiful soul, a pediatrician who studies asthma, who works in the community with asthma, or who did, it's long gone now, has a child with asthma, has a partner with asthma. And I did an interview with her daughter, and this was her map of living with asthma. So you can see how huge up on the left, this is her inhaler, how much bigger than her it is. So it really speaks to that, like how much space that takes up. And we don't think anything of handling a material piece of what we consider health and healing to somebody, like this is a part of your story, but we don't necessarily see this. You know, she's a beautiful little girl. What really, really struck me was when I shared this map with her mom just tears started pouring down her face because there's this section where she has her face and she says dizzy. And you can see all the lines around her face, and you can see her lips are wiggly and her eyes like show all of the like, what's going on? What's happening here? And her mom said, you know, she's talked about dizzy, but I had no sense of what she meant until I saw this picture. And that's where language can fail us, right? That's where art can show up to allow expression beyond what the linear language attempts to articulate. So those are a couple, but there's so many.
They're great. The picture we're looking at now, the dizzy picture, has the word, it's only in red and white, the word dizzy printed in block letters at the top. And then there's almost a heart-shaped sort of shape surrounding a head in the middle. And the mouth is sort of like just a wobbly line. The eyebrows are upright. Eyes look a little surprised. And there's a small nose. And then surrounding that head beneath the word dizzy are just red waves, shaky red waves that emanate out from her head. And that's why I think Marie is pointing out that there's no language or words that could do justice. This picture goes straight to an approximate understanding of what this girl's experience is.
And it really was part of my intention in the very beginning is that these maps could serve as a communicative tool, right? To help physicians and patients communicate their stories, but more importantly, to forward the patient's story in this way so that we could enter that lived experience outside of, not that we leave the clinical behind, but that informs the clinical in a very lived, living, visceral way.
Saves a lot of time to explain. It says it all right there. If you're a doctor, you couldn't not get that. Something you said earlier about the inhaler picture reminded mm-hmm. me of an episode that we've recorded for season 4 of Defining Moments with Jay Baglia, a communication scholar who recounted his journey with cancer. And he talked about how he didn't want his port implanted for chemotherapy. He had it in there. And then when the time came to remove it, he found himself strangely nostalgic and wanting to keep it after it was removed. He wasn't allowed to, and a nurse thankfully found a compromise. But this relationship we have to medical equipment, this ambivalence, this push-pull we feel, you can see that in the little girl's drawing of this humongous inhaler hovering over her. And she's standing in the middle with her head and a little tiara maybe or a crown and then her body.
She's 10 years old. She's a queen, of course.
Yeah. Well, good. And then her body looks like either lungs or sort of a heart.
Lungs in the shape of a heart, right? She has no legs here, no arms here in this picture. And she does take the time to sort of articulate the feelings, you know, sad, scared, alone, pain. And again, this little tiny face here. So you can see like, it doesn't tell you, you go this way, this happens first, but it's a map of experience over and through time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'd like to talk about your recent workshop that you did here.
Okay, great.
I loved it. It was a really big hit with the people who participated. And one of the participants was Megan Westerfeld, who our listeners may know. She was interviewed in the first episode of season 4 along with Lynn and I, and we talked about the Storytelling Institute. Megan, who was a videographer and also a tremendous driving force and creative, just a creative soul who really fueled so much of the Storytelling Institute's success over the last few years. So she attended, and at the time that Megan participated in your narrative mapping session, she was at a time of great transition. She had a young boy, a toddler. She was embarking on a move, different jobs. So there was a lot happening in her life. I'm going to describe for listeners, the actual map she drew to the best of my ability. And then I'm going to ask Marie to read a passage from a write-up that Megan did following that. She was so moved by the experience that she kept going back to the map, adding more, fine-tuning it, and then finally she wrote about the process. So I'll start by describing it. So what we see here is a large egg shape that takes up almost the entire page, leaving four corners where she has also written things into her map. She named her map Cracked But Never Broken. So the egg is in the center of the page, and it's punctuated by cracks and fissures throughout. It sort of segments the egg. In the center of the egg, however, is a swirling spiral with the words, my core, my power, my emotions. Now, in the four corners outside of the egg, Megan drew four smaller scenes. There were stick figures interacting, labeled family needs. There's an eye raining tears in a graveyard, in which she captioned global loss and despair. Another corner had a red medical bag with a heart on it that said physical constraints. And in the upper left-hand corner, she had a budding flower captioned ready to bloom, but hesitant. She went back to the map after drawing it over the course of a few days, and in the process, she found some Band-Aids, and she affixed them to three points where the largest cracks were on her egg, and added a few other things, and the map was complete. The experience moved her to write about it, and I've given Marie an excerpt here to read.
I visually narrate at a pace that surprises even me, emotions quickly spilling before I unintentionally bottle them up inside again. I will always protect family with my life, and I will always have my own little egg of me to protect as well. This fragile egg may crack across its surface at times, but I will keep my core strong despite external needs and internal voices that may push and pull in other directions. While I am fueled by my desire to answer calls for support, I must also make time to repair the cracks in the shell of my own egg. A few days later, I reflect upon my narrative mapping so far, and I gratefully acknowledge that I have the privilege of a loving community and good health. I hope deeply that my son will find my cracked egg map and these written thoughts one day. And when he does, I hope he finds himself in a place in life that has afforded him plentiful choices and ever-expanding possibilities to pursue his own journey toward healing. Whatever cracks he may have formed in life, uncracked, but not far from broken. We all are. We may each find healing in the small and big moments of all of our lives every day.
I think that is the kind of magic that emerges when you engage in Marie's narrative mapping process. So, Marie, as we wind down, what's next for you in your research on narrative maps?
First of all, I just want to say thank you. I think when I collect the reflections and hear people's stories, it's with such a sense of awe and wonder and gratitude that I've been gifted the opportunities to help create space for this. It's just really awesome in the finest meaning of awesome and filled with wonder for me. So I'm immense gratitude. I have dreams about creating labs for narrative mapping to work with physicians and therapists so that they can really help understand, and patients and physicians and therapists can get to portions of stories that resonate deep, deep within, that can afford healing and build stronger connections of healing. I mean, that's been always been a part of my question. What is healing, right? Not symptomatic relief, but enduring healing.
That's great. I cannot wait to see where you go with narrative maps. And I thank you for being a guest today on Defining Moments.
Again, Joe, it's been such a pleasure, such an extraordinary honor. I really have given my heart and soul and wonder to this work. And it's beautiful to see that so many people are making sense of it and see potential and will move it forward. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for joining Marie Thompson and I on this episode of the Defining Moments podcast. Defining Moments is produced by WOUB Public Media and the Barbara Gerrold's Institute for Storytelling and Social Impact. The Storytelling Institute imagines a world where storytelling creates just and joyful communities. Lynn Harder and I are co-producers, and Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. You can subscribe to Defining Moments at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the NPR Podcast Directory. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at DMPodcastWOUB. On our Facebook page, we provide links to Marie's health communication articles on narrative mapping. The articles contain photos of real-life narrative maps created by participants and students working with Marie. We hope you'll take time to review and rate this podcast. Thank you, and be well.